Chris said at the start of this last session, this is not the last leg of the climax, and there can only be one thing after the climax. It's obviously the anti-climax. I'll try to keep this as short and painless as possible. The range of papers and aspects of remembering and commemoration of wars has been incredible. It's been very impressive, extremely stimulating. Having grown up in Holland, as opposed to in Britain, as I have, I have another type of war memorial to add, which I think is probably pretty common on the continent, but not here, for obvious reasons, which is the reprisals memorial. And growing up, as I did in Holland, rather than lists of people who died in the war, if you know Holland is basically useless in fighting wars, so there are no glorious memorials to set up. But in the Second World War, towards the end of that war, any act of resistance would really be punished by reprisal of people who just rounded up and shot. So there are lots of memorials all over Holland, and as I say, throughout Europe, but that is perhaps the main memorial of the most recent major war. This is a whole different perspective on war again, and just to indicate that we haven't reached the full extent, perhaps, of ways of remembering war. But actually, all that thing with remembering, I think actually it was Charlie who was the only one to make explicitly the distinction between remembering and commemoration, and also relating it to poetry. We called it remembering war, I think. Commemoration, I think, as Charlie suggested, a more institutional and institutionalized, formalized form of remembering, I guess, of a very particular kind, with poetry and literature and arts, the visual arts, which we've seen some of, perhaps not quite as much as we should have done, being somehow in between. Maybe I'm thinking a way of actually linking remembering more broadly shaping memory into commemoration. Perhaps poetry, literature, and the arts have a role to play there. And generally, I think perhaps the link between these different forms of remembering, between the individual private memory and the very public monument, is something that we could think about further, explore further. I mean, what is the interaction between the two? Or is there actually a disjunction between the two? Do we find that public commemorations commemorate all very different things from the private memories? Or is there a tension between that? I think on the first day in Edith Hall's keynote lecture about David Jones's In Parenthesis, she pointed out that this is one of two out of 16 poets whose work was not or could not be recited in a commemorative context. And clearly there is a form then of remembering war, which, although she says it was essentially quite objective, as it were, perhaps precisely because of its objectivity, is not really suitable for public commemoration, because perhaps objectivity is the last thing we want in a public forum when thinking about war. So anyway, I think these perhaps are issues that were addressed in so many papers that I found extremely interesting and worth pursuing further. At least I'll be thinking about them further, certainly. Of course, there was a big element of reception both yesterday and today. I guess in many cases we focused on the how, what is taken out of classics and other periods of history and other literatures and other arts and used in remembering and commemoration in other periods. Not that it's a competition, but as I said, I think Bettina had a case study that cannot be beaten in terms of the scale of commemoration, which is where you have a battle that is commemorated with an entire city, restructuring the entire region, and then on top of that, having poets colonizing the sea as a part of the memorial as well. That takes a beating. That's the Romans for you. This is why I study Greek history, which is on a slightly more human scale, I always think. There were interesting themes in terms of how is the reception used, what kind of purpose does it serve? And to quote Edith again, she used that term trans-historical, so that's really one way of doing it, i.e. by referring to past parallels and examples to universalize, I guess, the experience, say this is how it always is, we are in that pattern. Perhaps sometimes also in Elizabeth's paper in particular, by Rupert Brooke, sort of there was a sense maybe that the classical was being used not to universalize, but to link specifically with the classical, to set it apart, to make it distinctive and better and more important than the other things we. So ostensibly these seem to be quite similar, which perhaps explains what Edith was complaining about regards the confusion or tone deafness of Paul Fussell in looking at this. You know, there come to have to be a fine line between universalizing and actually so setting yourself apart by alluding to the classical, and in terms of reception, that's perhaps an interesting general issue to consider as well. Okay, some distinctions that I think we didn't make explicitly, but that we have effectively covered between, I guess, who is doing the commemorating, whether it's public or private, which is not quite the same distinction as commemoration and remembering, I think. And we have relatively little, apart from the poets and the artists, relatively little of the private remembering, I think, although in Sylvia's paper right at the start, we had a whole range there of largely literary but still essentially private memorials and monuments. So the relation between those two, again, public and private, strikes me as very interesting. And the very interesting paper on the Simonides poem and its effect on Binion and perhaps beyond is an interesting example of that, where I would guess, it's no more than a guess, but on the whole, in private remembering, there will always be a mix of, you know, sort of admiration for the dead and sorrow and grief at loss, but that perhaps in private remembering, the loss and the grief will be on the whole stronger than the glorification, and perhaps in public commemoration, the reverse. And so that's like one of these things is interesting, because he kind of says that very explicitly. This is not a tomb, this is an altar. This is not mourning, this is praise. And there's a sort of denying, almost, rather alarmingly, that grief is appropriate in the circumstances when you're thinking about war and the war dead. That thing is not actually what we're doing, that's something to say as well, but that's another story. So anyway, I could go on, but simply I think it is worth thinking perhaps relatively systematically about all the aspects that we've covered. So, you know, private versus public. Of course, there was a class element to several of the papers that we talked about, you know, upper class versus lower class, to what extent these identities are shaped and formed by ways of commemorating and remembering war. Today, slightly also, well, yes, we've got a bit in Richard Robinson's keynote lecture yesterday and several times today, the gender distinction has come up. That's clearly another aspect that Richard at one point said, so far it's been a boy's story, and we all nod it because it had been. But you know, it's clearly a question worth asking again, you know, why? Why is it so much a boy's story? That's perhaps too easy to answer in some respects, but in what ways has it been a boy's story? To what extent has memory and commemoration been gendered, and not just by not talking about women, but talking in a gendered way about war? And finally, race also came up briefly. That's some, you know, in Felicitas' paper on East Africa, there the idea that you know, six-figure numbers of Africans that died in the most horrific, and literally, I think the phrase was drowning in the mud, were basically not registering almost in the commemorations. That perhaps there is, likely, I guess there is a racial dimension to that as well, and that is one that perhaps could do with more work. Finally, I think, you know, the question why. Why commemorate in certain ways, and indeed why commemorate at all? I mean, you know, it's been said, and again, the East African example, we're really not that interested in remembering the war. Why commemorate war at all? Why commemorate certain wars and others? Why commemorate certain wars in certain ways? That, I guess, is ultimately the big question for me, at least. But the now famous phrase, historian's question, comes to mind again. But I think it is. I think it is. I mean, in all seriousness, there are historians' questions and there are other kinds of questions. And I only ask historians' questions because I've thought no other questions for a very long time. So that's professional deformation on my part. But I do think the why question has perhaps not been addressed very insistently yet, and another thing that we can think about in terms of, again, I won't elaborate much more, but a point has come up repeatedly, that identity, of course, that commemoration is a key part of identity, whether, you know, gender, class, race, and so forth, but also national, most obviously, I guess, national. I started with the Dutch example, where, you know, I have no idea what that tells us about Dutch national identity, but that is the key war memorial. But it did strike me when moving to Britain that having so many First World War and other war memorials, remembering the war dead for several generations, and in most cases in sort of wars that one can fight easily present as sort of good wars, as wars that were worth fighting, where the sacrifice was worth it, etc. Which of course is, you know, only one way of thinking about war, but that is something that, that Britain does very effectively, very successfully and importantly, and one does wonder whether that is then one key element in shaping British as opposed to some other identities, that it has a long history of decent people fighting decent wars, if it were. That's perhaps an image that is being projected, that perhaps not very many other countries, no names, including Holland, cannot even begin to try. So you need to find another way of shaping your identity. And I imagine the ways of doing that are almost infinite, and this is why I suppose we probably need another conference. But for now, I would just like to say that I found all the papers uniformly excellent in the whole range of fields that they've covered, enormously impressive and stimulating. I imagine that any of you being made to do a summary like this would come up with a completely different summary because there was so much to cover. I've omitted a lot, but as I say, for the sake of keeping the anticlimax brief, I will stop.